Hi, this is Andrew, and this is Keen On, the daily now.tv chat show with some of the world's leading thinkers and writers. Hello, everybody. Regular viewers and listeners of the show know that we ran 10 excellent shows in association with C-SPAN. 10 books that shaped America with the C-SPAN presenter, my old friend Peter Slen. My favorite show was Slen talking about Thomas Paine's Common Sense. But we talked about all sorts of books, including The Common Law by Oliver Wendell Holmes, Adventures of Huckleberry Finn by Mark Twain, even Free to Choose by Milton and Rose Friedman, novels, nonfiction, economics, analysis of race. But the one thing that was missing, and of course this is the internet, so we're always going to get complaints, the one thing that was missing was poetry. So we're going to set that right today with my guest, Alyssa New. She's a world famous Harvard professor and now big PBS star. She is the director and host, and I think the founder of Poetry in America. It's entering season 4 on PBS. And she has got some of the most famous people of the world on screen, in front of the camera, to talk about poetry. So I'm thrilled and honored that Alyssa New is joining us from Scottsdale in Arizona, where she divides her time. This Poetry in America thing has become so big that she spends half her life now in Arizona. Congratulations, Alyssa.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Andrew. I'm delighted to be here. Thank you for that lovely introduction.
So are you the, I presumed, Alyssa, that you're the founder of Poetry in America. Tell me the origins of this project. It's a remarkably successful one.
Thank you so much. Well, I, for years, I taught courses, first at the University of Pennsylvania, and then at Harvard, courses that were directed at uninitiated poetry readers, courses that filled general education requirements, and they were called Poetry in America. And the challenge before me with those students, most of whom who were conscripts, they had to take a course in the humanities. My challenge was to send them away loving poetry. And I found that I had discovered ways to make that happen. And so when the opportunity, when video became, I've been doing this for a long time, so sort of pre-video, but at the moment at Harvard when it became possible to make massive open online courses using video, I was intrigued by the opportunities to use picture and music and timing and to begin to teach my subject in a multimedia way. And one thing led to another, massive open online courses. I don't know, instinctively, I guess I'd been a documentary fan for years. I began creating them documentary style, filming on location, trying to get unusual guests to talk about poetry with me, especially guests who were not expert in poetry, although they might be well known in other areas. And
Yo-Yo Ma for one, Shaquille O'Neal, a certain Joe Biden, the current American president. So you you got some pretty good people.
I have, and so the series was, and I showed it to PBS, a proof of concept, and they thought it looked exciting, and so 4 seasons later, here we are. And I have this marvelous privilege and opportunity to make short films, only 24 minutes, but in that time to immerse viewers, whether they are lovers of poetry from way back or new to the genre, I have a chance to immerse them in, often in just one poem, that will, I hope, over that half hour, show them what a poem can do. And poems can do many, many different things. I think part of the success of the series is in its variety, in the way it shows you, if you thought a poem was just about the expression of deep personal feeling, well, it could be, it can be about architecture or fungi, or it can have no people in it at all. So that's how it started.
And amazing. So you've done what many, many academics, many people who have a passion, you've done what we all dream of, turning your passion, which is clearly poetry, you're an academic, into a big-time media project. What advice would you give other people embarking on a similar sort of path? Of course, many have called on these sorts of things, fewer chosen. There's always going to be failure. But what accounts for your success? You've made it sound very easy, but you know as well as I do that it's anything but easy to take an idea and make it real, especially in the broadcasting space.
Yes, that's true. Well, I think to academics, what I would say is to think about that moment in a classroom when, and it doesn't happen all the time, but that moment when the whole, you know, you just feel like you're all levitating, when either you as an expositor at the front of the room, or your students around a seminar table are catching fire, and ask yourself with such love and devotion to the conversation at hand that they don't want to let it go. And something is happening that actually is a kind of script or a treatment for what would be compelling and interesting to anyone. And so, although my television series is now, produced with very high production values, and we have animation and, you know, beautiful music, and, you know, that we commission, really its origin was in my sense that the best way I have of reading a poem is not sitting by myself and reading it. The most exciting reading of poetry that I ever experienced always happened in a group. And if I could, and it, you know, always happened in an old-fashioned seminar. And if I could begin to figure out a way to share the energy of that, which means the energy of someone having an idea, dawning understanding in real time, because that's what real learning feels like. If I could do that, it would work not only for a classroom of Harvard students or University of Pennsylvania students or Arizona State students, it would work for everybody. And I think in a lot of ways, that is what people find so engaging about the series. They feel part of a small group of learners, of readers, who are discovering the depth of a work of art.
We're going to get to the poetry in a minute, Elisa. But before we get there, tell me about the economics. PBS is a public station. Did they invest in you? Do they make money on this?
No. There's a little bit of revenue that comes from this. But no, this is philanthropically supported. I have a National Endowment for the Humanities grant. I have a Sloan Foundation grant. There are a number of foundations that have, the Poetry Foundation, that have supported this endeavor from the beginning. And so the, you know, like most things in the arts, it is funded by enlightened people. Andrew, excuse me, I am going to cough for a second, so you're going to have to edit this out, I think.
Okay.
So sorry.
That was a poetic cough, Elise, so I think we'll keep it in.
Okay, go ahead. It's very dry here in Arizona. And
well, I think we're all envious of you, although it's quite warm in San Francisco, where I'm speaking from. Back to the ideal of public broadcasting, NPR has been in the news recently, lots of scandals around them and biases of one kind or another in public broadcast. Do you think that the relationship you have and what you're doing with Poetry in America with PBS, is that in itself an argument for public broadcast?
I hope so. Yes. I mean, I certainly think that nowhere except public broadcasting would I have been able to find a home for a television series on poetry. And I have spoken, spoken to various platforms in the for-profit world where, what ends up on the air is very much driven by popular taste. And I was told unforgettably that, in documentary, it's really all about true crime these days. Well, I like true crime as much as anybody, but the art form that I have wanted to share is one that I very much doubt could find a place on commercial media or certainly could have before proven. And I think now it's more, it's certainly catching the attention. We'll be airing as part of the PBS series on Amazon Docs, the PBS documentary series. And that, there's certainly the realization, I think, among the, on the commercial platforms that the arts have a strong and passionate audience, although from their perspective, a niche audience.
Some of these public broadcast networks and their subjects aren't always popular with conservatives. Have you had any pushback from conservative groups on this? Do you have to be careful politically to balance the different voices in poetry, or you just go with your own poetic gut instinct?
I think a lot about variety and diversity in the series. And I mean, fortunately for me, I don't have to try very hard because poets from every region, from every political perspective, from, old, young, black, white, gay, straight, great poets from all of those communities have contributed to and continue to contribute to our
even the Trumpian community, Elisa, are there some poets who vote for Donald Trump, do you think?
I don't know. I haven't canvassed or polled them. I'll give you an example of a show from this season that I hope will appeal across party lines, and I think it may. It's a very beautiful poem called Hill Country by Tracy K. Smith, who was U.S. Poet Laureate a few years ago. And Hill Country is a poem about Hill Country in Texas. And it begins at the top of a hill, 10 lines down. We learn that the top of a hill and a Jeep is descending the hill. 10 lines into the poem, we discover that the driver of the Jeep is God. Which is funny.
Is he ever gone? I bet it's a male.
He, that's a question. He has, in the poem, he has a name. And it's a he, and he's called a he. This poem is both a beautiful, ecologically sensitive treatment of the earth, and simultaneously a poem that discloses a long tradition of its debt to a long tradition of poetry about the hills, and specifically biblical poetry. And so the poem, as it develops in a long Wordsworthian column down the page, engages theological questions as well as ecological questions that I think will be of interest to viewers of all kinds, and certainly to faith communities. We filmed the episode in a Baptist church with the pastor and a number of congregants, and also with two rabbis, and with Jimmy Dale Gilmore, who is a Buddhist, sitting on his porch in Hill Country in Texas. And so it's my hope and belief that people who might not vote for the same candidate might vote for that poem. And that one of the things I try to do is to take us, at least in some episodes in the series, into places that may function as a kind of civic common ground.
We may need a third party, Elisa, or maybe we already got it, the poetry party. We're speaking with Elisa New, the Harvard professor and now director and host of Poetry in America, entering its fourth series season on PBS. Massive success. Everyone's seen something, and every show is built around a poem. A wonderful idea and wonderfully successful. It's great news. Finally, in our age of gloom, there's some good news. And I want to remind everyone that this high quality content, amazing guests like Elisa New, are brought to us because of our friends at Liberty, a quarterly journal of culture and politics. Leon Wieseltier, I'm sure, knows Elisa.
Yes, he does.
And I'm sure that he approves, just as Elisa will approve of Liberty's. We're going to run a short feature on Liberty's, and then we'll be back with Elisa New to talk specifically about poetry in America, what it is, the American poetic tradition. So don't go away, anyone. Don't go away, anyone. We'll be back in a short poetic minute.
News, the noise, there is nuance, insight. Liberty's is not just a journal of ideas. It's a meteor of intelligent substance. It's the place to be for engaged citizens. Politics, opinion, substance. Liberty's is a triumph for freedom of thought. A quarterly of urgency, of cultural exploration, of intellectual delight, of immaculate prose. It's invaluable. Subscribe now or find Liberty's at your favorite bookseller.
And you can subscribe to Liberty's at libertiesjournal.com. We're speaking with Elisa New, the director and host of Poetry in America, wonderful long-running PBS series. It's on its fourth series this year. Elisa, talk to me about poetry in America. I mean, obviously, every country, every tradition has a poetic tradition, great poets. Are there unique things about poetry in America? Is America distinguished by a certain kind of style of poetry?
I think that that American poetry is as diverse as Americans, although I would say that poetry, the name of the show is Poetry in America, which doesn't mean necessarily poetry by Americans. Two of the poets we are including in this season, Phyllis Wheatley, was an enslaved Black child who was brought to America on a slave ship,
and in the 1770s to Boston, right?
Yes, and in 1769, and there was no United States when Phyllis Wheatley wrote the poems that we feature. And as an enslaved person, she was not an American, although she sought through her writing to include herself in that community, and as you'll see in the show, did so very powerfully, even transforming or expanding our idea of what an American could be. The second episode in this season features the work of Joseph Brodsky and includes a poem that he wrote in Russian. Brodsky actually won the Nobel Prize as an American for a body of work largely written in Russian. And so Poetry in America has a pretty expansive and I would say exploratory. I continue to be curious. That's part of why I like making the series. And I expect that we will, include a poem in a coming season, by a Canadian poet and South American. We've already begun to include poets whose first language was not English, was Spanish, etc. So, but that was in, not to dodge your question, but I guess to pursue an answer that expressed more about the show itself. I do think that American poetry has a heterogeneity that comes from, the vast differences between American regions, between, excuse me again, so sorry. Between the ways English is spoken in different regions. There's some poems we've read where even though you're just reading them on the page, you hear the accent. We actually did one poem this season by a beautiful poem by Martine Espada, interpreters on screen were thinking about a word and a slightly odd piece of diction, and we included a spot in the episode, and he said, oh, I was actually just thinking about the Spanish, about this word in Spanish. And so that texture and that sort of mosaic quality is something that the series overall tries to capture, but it isn't like in a European country where there is one, long-standing ethnic tradition and language going with it, all tied to one landscape, one set. The America's too big for that. And its poetry, as Walt Whitman said, has a largeness and a multifariousness that goes with that.
An energy. It's all about movement. You mentioned Brodsky and Wheatley, both people, of course, who sometimes out of their own choice or perhaps not willingly came to America. How much of the work that you do in poetry in America, how much does it tell us about America itself as opposed to poetry?
Oh, I hope it tells us a lot. I hope that what it does is it opens a window or focuses a lens on a piece of America, whether it's the skyscrapers of Chicago or San Francisco's Chinatown or the steel mills of 1920s Detroit, that you might or might not know and you might or might not have seen in other documentary or read about in history books, but through the lens of the poem, through the language of the poem, you encounter and you come to know this place or this this aspect of American life in a completely different way. And I think that that's what poetry does. It uses intense and deliberate language to pick up or to sense and to sort of sharpen our senses in a way that we feel the very energy of a particular place. I talked before about, you know, this poem about Texas, where the very form in which the poem is written, it's written in loose blank verse that kind of winds down the page. The very form feels like a meditation in a beautiful sunlit space. It takes, right, the form of the poem takes, it tells you, oh, we haven't quite fully absorbed or gotten to the full saturation of this experience. Let's go a little further. Whereas, say, a poem like Frank O'Hara's Steps, which is the finale episode, which we do in the finale episode of this season, that poem, the poem is called Steps, and it dances. Its theme is dance, but the rhythm of it, it has the rhythm of 30s tap dancing with Ginger Rogers in it. It's balletic. And the resources of language, you know, in the hands of a great poet with a particular vision, allow us to see, say, the streets of New York that we may walk every day differently.
Somebody said, I'm not quite sure who it was, Elisa, you probably know where this quote came from, probably Winston Churchill or Mark Twain, that when it comes to politics, you campaign in poetry and govern in prose. Is that also, in a sense, true of life itself? Is poetry a form of dreaming? Can we live poetically? I mean, that may sound rather ambitious or rather romantic, but have you discovered in your travels around, in your conversations, in putting this show together, in the education stuff you're running, in your teaching, that one can live poetically?
Well, one can train, one can develop habits of attention and of, you know, as they now say, of mindfulness and gratitude that might constitute a kind of living poetically. I think that is what poets do, is they attune their senses and their minds and their hearts, you know, in different combinations. So each style is its own unique cocktail. They attune themselves to what's around them or what's inside them. And I think, I mean, that musical verb is probably a good one here. I think that's what living poetically is. It's attuning. It's being capable of paying attention to the shape and the color and the melody of the world around us in whatever medium. You know, one can live poetically in the visual. You know, as a photographer, one can live poetically as a quilter. It's really about I think it's really about an openness to what's around, which.
My wife's a quilter. I think quilting by definition is a form, a visual or a practical form of poetry.
Absolutely.
Have you found, and I'm sure you get this comment all the time, Elisa, that poetry can be a little forbidding, particularly in a country like America, where I think it was Coolidge who said the business of America is business, a very concrete prose-like existence. Your husband is a well-known fellow, Larry Summers, former Treasury Secretary and I think head of Harvard University. Do guys like Larry Summers, your husband, do they get poetry? Or does he shake his head when you start talking poetically to him?
He's not. I mean, we are an interesting pair. I am as uneducable in economics as he is in poetry. I think we have very different sensibilities, and you know, it makes for a fascinating life. But if we were treating each other as students, we'd probably be very, very frustrated. But I mean, to go to sort of the larger question, people do find poetry very forbidding. And I think that's because they think it's a test. A poem is a test, very sadistically crafted puzzle that they have to solve, usually by the time they finished reading, rather than that it's like a garden that where they walk through and they might look to the right and look to the left and enjoy it and walk one day and see one thing and walk the next day and see another. And I do think poetry is an art form that it doesn't go anywhere. A poem doesn't go anywhere. It lives on the page, or it lives in your smartphone on one of the great poetry apps. And it isn't, this is not an art form where you have one, it's not a play. It's not a concert.
It's not sports either. It's not. You don't win a poem, do you?
No, you don't. That's right. You don't win it. You don't lose it. And it's and it remains in the way that language remains in our minds. So I think thinking about a relationship with a poem as something that you can that can be very close or very remote, and that you have over time, maybe. A better model. And unfortunately, when poetry entered the schoolroom as a, actually when it entered the schoolroom in America, what people mostly did was memorize poems and recite them to their peers. And I think they enjoyed it more when they did that. And, you know, somewhere in the 1940s, we began a program of treating poetry like a hard academic subject. And in fact, poets were writing poems that qualified to be treated as hard economic objects, hard academic objects of study.
Your husband appearing as an
economist. There he is. There he is.
I hope you've had some economists on the show, Elisa. You've had some amazing guests. I mean, we mentioned Joe Biden, Herbie Hancock, Gloria Estefan, Shaquille O'Neal. Yeah, I mean, is there one? I know this is an impossible question, but is there one show that for you just somehow captured everything about the show? If someone is only going to watch one Poetry in America show, what should it be?
At the risk of sounding a little partisan, I will say the show on those winter Sundays, which does feature Joe Biden, along with the psychologist Angela Duckworth and the poet and now head of the Mellon Foundation, Elizabeth Alexander, as well as a group of men all talking about their fathers. This poem, Those Winter Sundays, written by Robert Hayden about his hardscrabble childhood as a Black kid in Detroit, it's a sonnet. It has a kind of formal elegance and a heartbreaking beauty that comes from its recognizability to us all. Any of us who have felt angry at a parent and grateful to a parent, any of us who have been a surly teenager who didn't appreciate a parent, will be moved by this poem And Joe Biden is in it.
And he knows a thing or two, for better or worse, you know, some good
about and some fatherhood.
Tragic things about, fatherhood and also being a son. So
exactly. And so thinking, so everyone in that show is thinking about being a father or being a son, being a parent or being a child. And it's just a very, very moving episode. And it was one of those in the first season. And so its production values might not be quite as high as those that they're good. It's a beautiful.
Well, you got season 4 coming up, Lisa. So
yeah,
you don't want to discourage people from watching that one.
No,
finally,
no.
I'm not going to ask you. I did the show earlier in the intro about the C-SPAN series on 10 books that shaped America. I'm not going to ask you about the 10 poems that shaped America or the 10 greatest poems, because that's a rather silly question even for me. But what about for you personally? You're an academic, a scholar. A lot of your work is focused on the Jewish experience of immigration. Your family is from Eastern Europe. Is there a poem or two that for you captures all the complexity, all the joy, and perhaps sadness of being a Jew in America?
That's a great question. I didn't know the question was going to go that way. I thought you were going to ask me who are your great poets, and I have to say
you can go that way as well. But
I'll say this: I often say that Walt Whitman is my rabbi, and
even if he isn't Jewish.
He wasn't Jewish. But his vision of America, the depth of it, the compassion of it, his own capacity to grow. We did Walt Whitman is the only poet about whom we've done 2 episodes over time. As a Jew, the episode that comes to mind, although, or even the poem that comes to mind, is by my friend Robert Pinsky. It's called Shirt. And Shirt is a poem about the history of garment making, an industry in which Jews figured very prominently in this country. It's an episode that has the infamous Shirtwaist factory fire in it, but it puts that piece of Jewish history inside of a global history. It's a poem about trade and about commerce and about beauty. And I think that as a Jew, I have always been curious about not only about the American Jewish experience, but about the way that experience was changed by the places Jews lived and by the whatever the historical currents of the moment were, and the effects of the growth of commerce on Jews, where commerce was often what allowed them to make a living. They were allowed to be middlemen. They were attracted to port cities. That has always fascinated me, and it's made the work that I've done in Jewish studies sort of, it's kept the lens wide and widening. I haven't yet done a poem aside from Shirt, which I love. I haven't yet done a poem that I thought of as really about being Jewish in America. Not sure which one that would be.